Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Freedom Report podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Today is Wednesday, September the 23rd, and we have got an interesting show for you today. It's one that the listeners have really demanded. Everybody's been telling me over the last couple days, I've got to hop on this story. They want to hear my point of view on it. And I decided to go ahead and jump in because I just got back from a trip to Washington, D.C. and New York. And if you guys are regular followers of my blogs and podcasts, you probably know that I was doing a taping of the John Stossel show on Fox Business. And that's going to appear this week, this Friday. So if you're hearing this before, if you're hearing this on the 23rd, you should tune in to John Stossel's show this coming Friday. It looks like it's going to be on the 25th. So the 25th on Friday at, looks like it's 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 p.m. Central Time. So set your DVRs and you'll see me with my hero, John Stossel. Very exciting. And again, that's on the Fox Business Network, so don't forget to check that out. Also, if you guys are fans of the podcast and you guys just tune in or listen on the website, don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on iTunes and on Stitcher, stitcher.com. And that's the Android app if you don't have an Apple device, so you can get us. And again, big fans, please, another favor, send us a 5-star review on iTunes. Just go and click ratings and reviews, click 5 stars. If you want to leave us a little written review too, that would be very helpful. And yes, I know you guys want to hear about the presidential campaign, so of course we will be discussing it, but you're going to have to wait till later in the show to hear all the exciting news and gossips. So do me a favor and listen all the way to the podcast. We're going to talk about this pharmaceutical CEO first up, and then we're going to get an update from the campaign trail straight from the man, Leif Bieberson himself, Liberty Champion. All right? All right. So this is an article that is we're going to be publishing this morning on the Libertarian Republic, and it was written by everyone's favorite libertarian feminist, Ovens O'Brien, the fantastic Ovens O'Brien, who is... I mean, she's probably just one of my favorite people I've never met that I feel like I'm friends with. Do you have those Facebook friends in real where they're not real life friends, but like you feel like you're super tight anyway? It's like you feel like you know each other. So if you like hung out, you could be like, oh, this is the first time meeting each other, but we're best friends kind of, but we're also, we don't know each other. So Ovens has written a tremendous piece this morning in her typical hilarious style. And I'm going to be reading from her article this morning about the pharmaceutical CEO. She's written a hilarious title for this. Pharmaceutical CEO is predictably douchey. Everybody's angry. Here are the facts. And this was going to be published this morning, so check this article out as well. This week, news came out. This is all Avin speaking, by the way. I won't try and use her voice. This week, news came out that a life-saving drug invented in 1953 was recently acquired by a pharmaceutical company, and the price was quickly raised from $14 a tablet to $750 a tablet. The price spike has created a flurry of outrage about greedy pharmaceutical companies, and most of it has been directed specifically towards the touring pharmaceutical CEO, Martin Shkreli. Much of this public outcry has led to many questions. Who is this douchebag, and why did he raise the price? What are patients supposed to do? Why are drugs so expensive in the first place? What would libertarians do about this? Oh, and that's all I have gotten in the last week, is just like, yeah, you libertarians, this is your fault. There's so much freedom out there. People are too free. That's the problem. They own something, and then they jack up the prices, and then they won't sell it to us for the price that we demand. Oh, those evil libertarians. Martin Shkreli is a former hedge fund manager. This is not the first time he's used a company to acquire the rights to a drug and jack up the price. The last time he did was in 2014 while CEO for Retrofin, Inc., and he was fired. As of Tuesday, it appears that Martin Shkreli has heard the roar of public opinion and has announced he will lower the price, though there's been no news on exactly what the new price will be. Though there are many reasons libertarians might claim this is a problem that wouldn't happen in the first place without the FDA and patent law, I'd like to point out that the other way that a libertarian society would handle unfair pricing is that consumers would turn on companies through various forms of awareness or shaming campaigns, such as what just happened in the last 3 days. And of course, if you remember, of course, this happened to like the Mozilla Firefox CEO, right? So he got hounded out of a position at the head of Firefox after a public shaming campaign came out. So there's no law needed, just social fury, as the social justice crowd has proven repeatedly. And Ovens goes on. Anyways, Daraprim is a drug that fights toxoplasmosis. Wanted to make sure I pronounced that properly. Toxoplasmosis is particularly dangerous for individuals who have weakened immune systems, such as pregnant women and AIDS patients. Daraprim was purchased by Turing Pharmaceuticals on August 10th, 2015 for $55 million. Drug prices rising upon ownership changing hands is pretty common. The percentage of this increase is what's so notable about it. We all understand that prescription drugs tend to be expensive, if not for us, then for our insurance companies. It's a common complaint, and it's worth it to take a moment to understand why. Those who understand how research and development works know that new medications cost tremendous amounts to create. Though a single pill of a medication may, in actual production, cost $2 to manufacture, the first pill of it might have cost millions to invent. According to some studies, research and development is up to $2.5 billion. This is the cost for a single drug, except that, due to the high failure of pharmaceutical research, this number often includes the expense of the failures, for which there will never be a way to recoup costs. Other studies, in a book called The $800 Million Pill, The Truth Behind the Cost of New Drugs, puts the cost of new medications below $1 billion. So think about that. Not only are you paying for the actual drug, but you have to pay for all the research and development for the drugs that failed. So you've got to be able to get those costs under control when you're actually selling drugs. So why are medicines so expensive to manufacture? Besides the obvious thing about the miracles of modern medical science requiring a lot of trial, error, education, and experimentation, there's also the fact that the FDA must approve drugs before they can be sold. On average, it takes over 12 years to get a drug from laboratory to pharmacy shelves. Once a drug has been successfully developed in a laboratory, there will be 3 to 4 years of testing before an application can be sent to the FDA, which can then approve trials on humans. Only 1 in 1,000 different drug compounds developed in a laboratory is likely to make it to human testing. The process of human testing is another 3 years. Only 1 in 5 drugs makes it through the human testing. Upon successful completion of that step, the company submits an application averaging 100,000 pages to the FDA, which may take another 2 to 3 years to approve it. 1 in 5,000 compounds developed in a laboratory will make it through the FDA's entire approval process after about 12 years. There's all that other money, the ghost of those pills that simply didn't survive. Now, this is Ovens' opining here that I'm reading. Now, look, I love to hate on Big Pharma just as much as everybody else. However, imagine you pour millions of dollars into equipment, samples, laboratory space, scientists, whatever else you need to do this, and you absolutely will not see any return from it on average for 12 years. That return may happen if you're lucky enough to have developed a compound worth testing at all, and that anybody needs or wants to buy. Though I'm all for safe and effective medication, there's a number of reasons the FDA doesn't appear to be the best way to save lives or effectively respond to health crises. One of these reasons is their abysmally long approval process that keeps medication out of the hands of those who will literally die without the chance to try it. At the time that Daraprim underwent the FDA's approval process, the average time from application to market was 7 months. Granted, this was prior to the Kefauver-Harris Amendment of 1962, which completely changed the way new drugs were approved and regulated in response to the thalidomide birth defects crisis. Daraprim has been on the market for over 60 years, and clearly its research and development costs have been recouped. In fact, after so many years, the patent has expired, so a generic alternative should exist, right? However, Daraprim doesn't have a large market. The New York Times estimated approximately 8,000 to 12,000 prescriptions are filled annually. Now that's really the key there. It's not necessarily the most financially sound move to attempt to manufacture and produce the generic, as there's little profit incentive and some potential risks trying to compete within that market. What's the solution then? This is America, where he and his company have every legal right to profit, and no libertarian wants a government solution against profit. Rather, personally, I'd rather avoid overemphasizing our self-congratulatory libertarian analysis that this wouldn't have happened if we were in charge, due to our condemnation of the FDA or frequent libertarian positions against intellectual property. It helps to articulate our positions when these matters arise, but it's not going to help, and she puts in italics, it's not going to help this situation. The best we can do in these moments is to take the time to explain why government monopolies enable greedy people to take advantage due to a lack of competition or without the natural regulations of the market. In the meantime, maybe the social justice activists have a point. When you've got no other cards to play, maybe the fact that this man's name and face are all over Twitter, Facebook, and the major news organizations, such as the a-hole or the douchebag of pharmaceuticals, is enough to make him change the prices significantly. We'll just have to wait and see. Well, Ovens, I'm going to agree with your analysis, but perhaps I disagree with your remedy. Perhaps I wouldn't take the pill that you're trying to sell at the end here, Ovens. It went through a long approval process, but you're not the one in 5,000 cure that I'm going to decide, Ovens. But you've done a tremendous job. Ovens does a tremendous job of breaking this down. This is why she's one of the best in the business, and I'm so lucky to have her. But I'd like to say that I think that, yes, we should use an example of this to educate people. And maybe we shouldn't be douchey, but you have to understand, Ovens, the psychology here. There is an entire group of people who just want to find a douchebag and kill him, right? So one of the big things right now is just a hate on frat boys, hate on white males, you know, cis, hetero, check your privilege. That's what social justice warriors are all about. Now, if this guy was a minority, for example, or if he was a woman, I'm sure that there would have been some anger pointed at her, but not the serious character attacks against the person because of, you know, the word douchey is sort of code name, right? For like, you know, young white males who happen to have curly hair and live a life of privilege. To me, I think that the reality is that he has hiked this drug up to what you would call a fair market price. And if Turing Pharmaceuticals has to make a profit and they have to be able to invest in other life-saving drugs, well, then this is probably what they have to charge. And remember, this is a small market, 8 to 12,000 people take this drug. So what, we have national outrage over this very, very tiny sliver of people, but look who are the people who are affected: AIDS patients and pregnant women, two groups that are protected classes. So you can pretty much bet that anything that affects this group of people who are taking this pill, we're going to hear about it, right? And we're certainly not going to get good facts from the media because they all have an inherent bias. And most people are economically illiterate. Gosh darn it, why do you think so many people support Bernie Sanders? You know, there's a reason why his campaign is taking off because, you know, like Thomas Sowell said, most of, you know, the history of politics is replacing what worked with what sounded good. And, you know, certainly it sounds horrible that he's jacked up these drug prices to this exorbitant cost. Yeah, well, perhaps Turing Pharmaceuticals had to spend billions of dollars trying to develop another drug, another life-saving drug, and this company needs the profit from a drug that does sell and does work, that has been approved, so that they can use it to invest in research and development for other drugs. And listen, I mean, if it's a small market, 8 to 12,000 people, they probably have to jack it up to that price because they're not going to be selling a lot of it and because it is an important drug. It's supply and demand, basic supply and demand. Now, we don't know. I mean, $730 for a pill is probably not going to be the market where the market price is going to land on this, especially now that the public backlash has occurred. And I don't like the way that people have treated this guy. Like, I don't agree with Ovens, you know, saying perhaps this guy deserves it, or that, you know, maybe he's douchey and stuff. Those are her words. Because if anything, you know, this guy is doing his job. But when it comes to the reality, we should be using this as an opportunity to educate people about these two issues that Ovens has nailed down. That's intellectual property laws and on the FDA. Now, the intellectual property laws don't necessarily apply to this case specifically, again, because in this case, the patent has run out. So anyone could come in and compete. But remember, when he jacks up those prices, he creates a profit incentive for other people, because if they are selling that product at that price, then it becomes likely that someone will come in and compete because there's a profit incentive there. So, you know, he may have actually incentivized one of his competitors to come in and to start creating that drug. And that's the thing, is that, you know, again, replacing what works with what sounds good, right? So overnight, people probably would want, like, pass legislation immediately, you know, or maybe even arrest this guy. You know, if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, you'd probably be, you know, happy to see this guy in jail and, you know, an AK-47 to the back of the head like the old days. But no, in free market America, you can have pill if you can afford it. Of course, you know, the problem here, of course, is that we all just look at the simple economics of it. Oh, it costs this much. But there's always the hidden costs that are involved, and that comes back to the FDA. So, of course, a lot of the money that is tied up in this is in research and development. And if people want to be able to take drugs that are life-saving drugs, that are risky drugs, they should be able to do so with the caveat that they understand the risks of doing so. But the Food and Drug Administration, which is the, you know, the unitary monopolized government force on a regulatory force when it comes to our food and drug supply, they're not going to allow the market to sort these problems out, because they're going to create all this moral hazard in the system, and they're going to create a lot of the problems for people who need to get life-saving drugs. Right, and there are a lot of examples of people who have died while waiting for drugs to go through the research process. People who aren't allowed to access potentially life-saving cures because the Food and Drug Administration's approval process is so egregious. Now, should the approval process for drugs that are tested on humans be egregious? Sure. But should people be barred from taking drugs that they'd like to take? Should people be, should people be denied that right to do what they like with their bodies if they decide to take a risk on a controversial cure? I think they should. I mean, goodness knows, we've got people taking all kinds of stupid crap that hasn't even been approved by the FDA, like homeopathic medicine, which is, you know, quack science and pseudoscience and fakery and sham science. But people are allowed to take those things, and those are sold right in the prescription drug aisles. If you go to your pharmacy right now, you can go and buy quote-unquote medicine, homeopathic medicine, and remember, that's big quotes there. You can go and buy that kind of junk and pretend like it's going to be a cure, and you know, take your sugar pill or your placebo, and people are allowed to do that. But then when you get into actual medicine and cures, oh, well, then of course it's heavily regulated. And on its face, it makes sense. But libertarians argue that first of all, we argue that the FDA shouldn't exist. Why? Not because we don't think that drugs should be tested and scanned, and that they shouldn't go through a rigorous process of elimination in order for them to actually be tested by humans. But we believe that the FDA should be abolished because we think that the marketplace should handle the adjudication of these drugs, meaning that the drugs should be analyzed and tested by private research agencies so that the consumers can have an option, right? Right now, we have no option. A single federal monopoly on how prescription drugs are approved here in the United States. And to me, I would rather see a regulatory scheme that is a market regulatory scheme, where consumers would have multiple different consumer advocate agencies that would be allowed to compete with the FDA, and we'll see who does a better job. Personally, I think that if the market was allowed to regulate these kinds of situations, that we would have lower prices overall, we would have people getting cures faster, there would be some danger involved. Remember, personal responsibility does come into play, and I don't want to pretend like it doesn't, because some people might take drugs and might be harmed. Some people are already taking drugs and harmed, though. So again, the risk should be placed on the individual who decides to take the drugs, and that the people who, I mean, you can be held liable, or you could be held accountable, perhaps, if you poison a lot of people. But right now, if the FDA approves it, then if the FDA approves the drug and a lot of people get harmed by it, then they're sort of shielded. They've got a little bit of immunity for the fact that they went through the rigorous process of the FDA and they passed all the FDA approval processes. And so then they're going to be shielded from lawsuits to a certain extent, right? Now, of course, there's always going to be there have been class action lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies. I believe Fenfen was one of them that went through the process and got approved. But I think that we have to reevaluate what exactly we want the United States to look like in terms of our pharmaceutical health. And to me, I think this is a great example for us to get into the issue. Unfortunately, I don't know that it necessarily makes libertarians look good. It just makes us look smart. Because unfortunately, what looks good and what's actually good are oftentimes two different things. You know, the beautiful, sweet lies. Everybody loves beautiful, sweet lies. It's the cold, hard, slap you in the face with a wet fish truth that people really just don't like. So in a case like this, no matter how much we try and explain economics to people, no matter how much we rail against the FDA, you can't win something like this, because emotion is just always going to come into play. The pregnant women's, their drugs were just gone up, you know. Pregnant women probably have husbands with jobs and can afford to pay for drugs, right? It's, you know, the AIDS patients, of course, that's a whole different ball of wax entirely. But of course, if you have a situation where a protected group, a protected minority group, or a group of people who are sympathetic are going to be harmed negatively by something, it doesn't matter how small it is. It could be like, you know, it could be, I'm trying to think of some, like, what is the most obscure minority group? Like Native American, you know, Jews for Jesus, you know, converted Jews for Jesus or something. So if you have like the most, intense minority group that is a special interest and they're being negatively affected by some, some blurb in the marketplace, well, you can tell that the Daily Beast and every left-wing rag, Raw Story, they're all going to jump on top of it, call the guy a douchebag, assassinate his character, create a firestorm of outrage, and they're going to crucify this guy. But are they going to sit around and start to talk about the economics of prescription drug coverage? Yeah, after they've ruined this kid's life. Yeah, after they've destroyed him. And the part of the reason why they're so angry at this guy is because they say he's been a douchebag because he's been taking to Twitter and saying F you to his haters. Well, Mr. Shkreli, I mean, you're my boy. That's one of my favorite things to do as well. You know, like when you got an army of haters on you and you've done what you think is in the your best interest and you've done your due diligence, you can look after yourself. You know, you're allowed to make profit in this country. You know, you're allowed to get on Twitter and say what you want to say and say F you to your haters. And sometimes you do have to do that, ladies and gentlemen. You know, that's the thing, is everybody's like, oh, be nice, be nice. Oh, you should have this bad PR. You know, yeah, there's a lot of things that are bad PR, but you know what? It's just people respect people who stand up for themselves, you know, who say, I don't give a damn, you know. That's what the Atlas Shrugged was all about, you know. That was what that was all about, was that, you know, that the elite had the guts to shrug, to shake off the haters of the world, because they were the creators, they were the doers, they were the builders, they were the ones who were actually creating everything that was of value. So the concept of the novel is that Atlas shrugs, right? So that the greatness, the greatest of society decided to not be forced to manufacture or to forced to be creative or to use their talents for people who didn't respect them, who just thrived off of being parasitical. And so I guess Martin Shkreli, you know, yeah, we're not going to win any fun friends from defending you. But the fact is that the pharmaceutical industry is much more complex than a lot of these pundits are making it. They're just trying to engage in character assassination to protect their own favored minority groups. Otherwise, hey, great article here, Ovens. And I'm going to go ahead and move on to the campaign, which you, I know you guys, a lot of you guys stuck around for. Thanks for sticking around. Very exciting. First, let me just tell you that what I've been doing is going around. I was in Washington, D.C., and I was in New York. Is I've been going around to a lot of the big institutional libertarian people out there. So there are a lot of people who have founded institutions in Washington, D.C., and New York, who are very libertarian, who right now, the majority of the support is behind Rand Paul. And, you know, more power to him, because, you know, Rand Paul winning the Republican nomination would be nothing but a good thing for the United States. And I want what's good for America. The reality is that we may not get a Rand Paul presidency. We might not get it. And if we don't get a Rand Paul presidency, well, then I got some good news for you, ladies and gentlemen. I am running for president. And what I have been doing is trying to seek the nomination for the Libertarian Party. Now, there's going to be a lot of barriers for me. There's going to be a lot of speed bumps along the road to my path to hopefully securing the nomination for the Libertarian Party. So what I've been doing is not only working with grassroots to build a core of activists in order to help me secure the nomination, but I've also been going to institutional libertarians and going to libertarians who have access to resources, who have access to money, and securing promises from them that if for some reason Rand Paul doesn't win the nomination for the Republican Party, that I can secure some funding and some support for my own presidential run. And that would occur if I win the nomination in May of 2016. So here are some of the important details. Now, if you are interested in supporting the campaign, if you are convinced and you're like, hell yes, Rand doesn't win, Austin Peterson 2016 for the Libertarian Party, well, here are some things that you can do. The first thing that you can do, that would be the simplest thing to do, would be to search for, on Facebook, the Austin Peterson for President 2016 Facebook group, okay? So if you can join us there, you can get embedded with the rest of the activists, find out what's going on, and perhaps start to get active. If you've got some skills, you can get in touch with our volunteer coordinator. And her name is Samantha May Tanner. She's cool as heck, and she is in Florida. Which is great, because the national convention is in Florida as well. So it's in May. And it's actually important, if you want to go to the national convention next year, if you'd like to become a delegate, right now is the time when you need to join your local Libertarian Party and express your interest in becoming a delegate. Now, there are a lot of people who are libertarians who don't care for Leif Bieberson. They don't care for your host, the Liberty Champion. That's okay. It does make it harder for me, but it's going to work just like it does in the Republican and primaries, where if the head of the Libertarian Party is an Austin Peterson hater, then if you tell him or her that you would like to become a delegate so you can come and vote for me in Orlando next year to help me secure the nomination, they might just say, oh, yeah, our meeting is next month, blah, 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 blah. And then you don't realize that in 2 weeks is the deadline to register as a delegate. So they might give you misinformation. And that's because I've already found out that some of these state chairs are doing that. So it's going to be difficult for me. I'm going to try and win a lot of these state chairs over and go on a charm offensive with them to try and convince them that they should welcome my supporters into their parties with open arms and help them to become delegates, because that's good for the Libertarian Party. You know, it's not just good for me. It does help build the local party. And I'm trying to get quality people to the convention in May of next year. And right now it's looking as if, you know, my only competition is going to come from Gary Johnson. And Gary Johnson hasn't even declared that he's going to run yet. So we don't even know what the LP nomination race is going to look like yet. So we've got some other candidates in the race, Mark Allen Feldman, this guy named Gerard Perry, I believe is his name, yes, and Steve Kerbel. And these all appear to be pretty good men. And I've checked into their records, and they appear to, you know, be good strong libertarians, and I simply think that I've probably got a better chance. So if there was a poll done today by registered delegates, I would predict, and I'm trying to be objective here, But I would predict that because I just announced recently and because I'm sort of an unknown name, that I would probably come in to Gary Johnson within the margin of error. So maybe if it was just me versus Johnson, he might win with maybe like 55% or something like that, 55% of the vote. And, you know, I'd come in maybe a second with like five or six points of difference there. And provided that I was given an opportunity to debate and we had a chance to speak to each other, some of that. But if you did a poll today, I would pretty safely assume, I think, that I could come in a close second to Gary Johnson. So that being said, that means I have a lot of work to do in order to get my name out. I need to go out around and speak to a lot of these conventions that they're having around the country at the Libertarian Party conventions, and I've already started doing that. So when I was in Virginia in the D.C. area, I went and spoke to the George Mason Libertarian group, and I've been reaching out to a lot of student groups across the country in order to secure speaking engagements at their events so that I can reach the young people. I mean, I know that a lot of the young people aren't necessarily directly involved in the Libertarian Party. It's a lot of the old people that I really need to, older people who are already delegates, who have been in the Libertarian Party for years, and that I have to schmooze those people. But because this is a generational movement, because I'm trying to get libertarian ideas to plant seeds for libertarians in the future, I think it is very important. I cannot neglect the youth, even if they don't vote or participate with the Libertarian Party, because, again, this is about spreading ideas and about providing a plan for the future for the liberty movement to continue to grow. See, one of the primary reasons why I've decided to seek the nomination is because I simply think that we don't have a lot of good options right now, and that if Rand Paul were to drop out, then we would have a long, dark period of no libertarian candidate really going out and hitting the road and driving a lot of energy and activism behind our ideas. I mean, perhaps Governor Johnson would, but he hasn't even declared yet. He's been sort of on the fence about it. And somebody's got to be a champion. You know, somebody's got to get out there, take the ninja sword, and start slicing statists. So when I looked at the field, I thought, well, there really isn't a lot of people who can be that warrior. We need a warrior. And I reluctantly decided to jump in. It wasn't like I was like, oh, hell yeah, I'm going to run for president. I'm so excited. It was kind of more like the, what's that scene from the movie where I think it's Pirates of the Caribbean, where, you know, Jack Sparrow kind of like looks at the enormous, it's Lord of the Rings, where I think it's Legolas sees like another giant that he's got to take from. He kind of like sighs and then screams and jumps on top of him. You know, it's like, ah, oh well. And then, rah! This is kind of the battle that I've taken on for myself. I feel like it is a good titanic struggle between the forces of darkness and statism and big government and socialism. And we are losing ground right now. There is nobody out there championing these ideas at the highest levels other than Rand, and Gary's sort of non-existent on the scene. So I took up this sword because I just thought that I could do a good job. I thought that if there wasn't going to be a liberty champion in that dark time, that I would stand up and do it. And hopefully what'll happen is that I'll be able to maintain momentum throughout the primary season and be able to build upon it and to build the liberty movement, or at the very least not have us lose any ground. You know, we've got to stay on the offense in order to keep our enemies on the defense. If we are right now allowing the statists to drive the debate and allowing the forces of big government to be the newsmakers, then we're going to lose, and the ground that we've lost now will come back to haunt us in the next battle in 2020, 2024. We have got to continue to hold the ground that we've taken and advance, or else we're going to be in big trouble. So I plan on being the vanguard, at least to the best of my ability. And you know, the nomination is a popularity contest, and here's the truth, folks. And I've got to be objective about myself and hold up the mirror of self-reflection. And sometimes I don't like what I see, even in myself, because the reality is that, you know, sometimes I don't win popularity contests. You know, to be honest, sometimes I can be a bit abrasive. I'm not base or coarse, but I can be a bit crude. So I'm going to have to put on the charm offensive. And, you know, I don't like politicians, right? I don't really want to be one. But in order for me to secure the nomination, I do have to do some smiling and shaking of hands and be nice to people who are not going to be nice to me up front, and sort of do unto others as you would have them do unto you in that sense. Whereas my libertarian instinct is more of the porcupine. You know, if you tread on me, then I'm going to tread right back. And, you know, I think there is some room for the Donald Trump strategy in there, you know, where you can be a big jerk and say what you mean and be politically incorrect. It's sort of, you know, and that's refreshing for people. And it may not always work, but when it comes to delegates and things like that, you know, libertarians tend to be a bit sensitive too. You know, like they get their feelings hurt as well when you criticize things like the non-aggression principle, or if you say you don't agree with Murray Rothbard, or if you don't agree with Ron Paul on something. And I think, you know, that's going to be my biggest challenge. That will be my biggest challenge, is to convince the hardcore of hardcores that I really am one of them. But the reason why, I think, is because, not because I couldn't do it, it's because I think it's part of the venue, right? So one of my biggest strengths is, you know, people who say they know me from online, they say, oh, well, he's a jerk, I don't like him, blah, blah, blah. Well, that may be because they only gave me a cursory glance, they read or saw one thing that was controversial, and they made a snap judgment. But people who have met me in real life, or friends who know me, say, wow, it's totally different. This is just like, it's like a different world. And I feel like, you know, people who really know me really do like me. So that's going to be my challenge, is to try and get around to all these state parties and meet these people person to person and sit down and have a beer with them. Am I the type of person that you'd like to have a beer with? Maybe that's what's going to help me win. That's how I'll get into the White House, is showing how cool I would be to have a beer with. But in reality, ladies and gentlemen, in all seriousness, you know, this is what I told John Stossel on the show, and you'll see this on Friday. I think I can do better. I think I can do a good job. I think that I would be a good presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party, for the Liberty Movement. And remember, there are all sorts of victories to be won along the way, not just the White House. Of course, you have to aim for the White House. You have to do your best to try and win the White House. But there are other victories to be won as well, such as ballot access. You know, if the Libertarian Party candidate polls at 3%, if they can get 3% of the vote, which no candidate has gotten yet, but if they can get 3% of the vote, then they can get automatic ballot access in a certain number of states, right? So what happens is that, you know, you say, well, I may not win the presidency this time, but I'll be back in 4 years with 1,000 of my friends, and they're going to get automatic ballot access because of how well we did in the last election, so we're going to do even better in this election. So, I mean, there are opportunities. There are all sorts of opportunities to be had. If you are willing to put in the work, if you're willing to do the hard work for liberty, the politicking campaign that's necessary in order to increase our numbers, increase our visibility, and to really win. Because winning isn't just winning the White House. Winning can be getting building the Libertarian Party, you know, building regional movement, maintaining the public's eye on our ideas. You know, everybody was saying this is the libertarian moment, and here we are, we're allowing all of our momentum to fade. I want to push that forward and provide a beacon for people to rally to, an icon, so that people will continue to be interested and excited in these ideas. You know, I'm a young, fresh face, so hopefully that will be interesting to people. They'll say, oh, who's this new young guy in the race? And he's talking about how he loves America, and he's talking about the opposite of what Bernie Sanders says. You know, like, instead of, blaming immigrants for our jobs crisis, this young libertarian man is talking about how immigrants actually contribute more to the economy than they take out in benefits. So we're going to have this debate, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to have this discussion, and I'm going to center my campaign around the theme, the concept of corruption. That's really what it's going to be about. It's going to be an anti-corruption campaign. And I'm going to focus on the 5 institutions of government that are the most corrupt. Now, me and my panel of economic advisors, which I am assembling. No, I really am. And my panel of economic advisors and I are going to find the 5 most government the most corrupt government institutions, hone in on them, and offer a plan to the American people for reform. I think that at least the 2 of them will be the IRS and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Of course, we know that we would love to abolish those two institutions. But if we couldn't abolish those institutions right away, what sort of a transition plan do the best and brightest minds, Austrian economists, Cato scholars, people who are on our side of things, what are the best solutions that are being proposed today? I'm going to work with a panel of those scholars to put together that research in order to provide a platform to the American people that will be reasonable, that we can effectively use to batter the Republicans and Democrats over the head with. Because another victory that we could potentially have, not just ballot access or winning the White House, is we might poll high enough to terrify the two major parties into adopting some of our platform planks. That can be a victory too. And I know people kind of like, that's sort of conceding defeat. Well, if you think you're going to win the White House as a 2016 Libertarian Party president, I mean, you know, maybe you need to readjust your ballast measure here. You have to try, right? You've got to do your best to win the White House. And, you know, if there was some insane revolution of thought and people were all of a sudden were like, oh, hell with Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, you know, and Jeb Bush and those guys. Well, we want this young Libertarian Party president guy because he's got the right solutions. If that happened, tremendous. I would love to appoint Julie Borowski as Secretary of State and, Peter Schiff to the Treasury and Judge Napolitano to the as Attorney General and eventually to the Supreme Court. I would love to see that happen. I would love to do all that, and I would. But another victory that we might have is if we build a credible platform, then we can take our ideas to the American people, and maybe if the major party candidates see that we're getting traction, they might take on some of those ideas for themselves. So there are lots of victories to be won along the way, and that's always been my strategy, ladies and gentlemen, is you go for shoot for the stars, and if you get the moon, well, you know, that's terrific. And so there are a lot of victories to be won, and I really want to start pounding these issues home once I get my economic advisors to agree on a set plan. And I'm hoping that you guys are going to support me. So if you've listened this far, you probably are really interested in the campaign. I've put together the basics for a campaign committee. I'm still lacking one very important role in order for me to formally file with the FEC. I'm seeking a treasurer right now. That's probably the most difficult part of a campaign because that involves liability and you got to have somebody you can trust, somebody who's good with numbers, somebody who can, you know, help you with compliance. And of course, since we're libertarians, we are underfunded, but hopefully we're going to find someone soon. Once we do, we will formally file with the FEC, and then we will go through the process of putting together the final touches that we need in order to put out a strong campaign. And that's when I think the big media is really going to take notice. You know, we had the John Stossel interview last week where we were sort of the first national interview, but we have yet to have like an exclusive sit-down interview. I'm thinking maybe that should be with Ben Swan. What do you say? Any Ben Swanners out there? They probably a good idea, right? Give Ben the first exclusive. We'll see. Haven't talked to Ben yet about it. Not sure what he thinks about it yet. We'll see. But this is what's going to happen. We're going to put together a real platform. We're going to offer a real transition plan to the American people. We're going to drive home the problem of government institutions that are corrupt. And we're going to talk about these issues because that's what America needs. You know, we do need real reform. We need real reformers. So I'm going to offer that plan up, and I'm dead serious about this campaign, and I hope that you will join me. So if you are a libertarian and you want to get involved with the presidential campaign, do me a favor. Go to Facebook and, first of all, like my page. You can find Austin Peterson. This is the Freedom Report podcast, which you can find on iTunes and Stitcher. But join the Facebook group, Austin Peterson for President 2016. If you can't find it and you have questions, you know, send me a message. I respond to every message that I can on my Facebook page. So just go ahead and add me there, send me a message, or send me an email through the Libertarian Republic. If you have any questions, of course, if you want to donate, that would be fantastic. And I know I realize people are times are tight, money's tight. And times are hard, so if you can't donate, you know, $1,000, which I totally understand, then perhaps, you know, $10 or $5. And the reason why these small donations matter is because, one, they all add up, and then, two, it's the amount of people who are donating that really matters. The amount of people, if we can get lots and lots and lots of small donors, well, we can do tremendous things. And we saw that with Ron Paul, where he got millions from small donors. And so I would hope that I could convince the Liberty Movement that my campaign would be worth funding. I mean, hopefully at such tremendous levels. I don't expect that. I think there was something unique about Ron Paul that energized people that perhaps, you know, I might not be able to tap into. And that's just me being realistic, simply because of the fact that there are quite a few differences between myself and Dr. Paul. You know, he's a tried and true congressman. He's got years of experience, and he's absolutely beloved because of his kindness and gentleness. I tend to be a bit more brash, a little bit more bold, a little bit more, you know, bossy. And I tend to be a little bit more out there. So perhaps I won't be able to tap into exactly what Ron Paul had. But on some level, I hope that I can, because I am very sincere about these ideas, these same ideas, very inspired by Dr. Ron Paul. And I'm hoping that I can continue to carry the torch for a short time through this national election, up until November of next year, whenever whatever statist is going to be in charge of us next time. I hope that if we cannot win the White House, that we can make whoever walks into that office do so with a black eye and scratches all over them from having to tangle with the Liberty Movement. Let's not make it easy for them. So join my campaign. Go to AustinPeterson2016.com if you'd like to donate. Send us, you know, a buck or two, and that'll help us continue to do what we do best. You know, because again, I'm gonna be, you know, I'm gonna need to just like buy plane tickets, but otherwise, I'm gonna crash on people's couches. I'm not so prissy as a lot of people. I don't have to fly first class or stay in the nicest hotels. As long as I'm there, that'll be just fine for me, because it's all about spreading the message, and I'll do my best to do that for you guys. So. What do you think? Are you excited? Send me emails. I love hearing from you guys. Please don't hesitate to ask me any questions that you want. I hope you enjoyed the show. Like I said earlier, please subscribe to the Freedom Report on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher. Leave us a good 5-star review on iTunes. Join the campaign, and don't forget to come back every single day to your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at the Libertarian Republic.com.